Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today we're going to have some highlights from Donald Trump's acceptance speech and Hillary Clinton's concession speech. We'll have some analysis of what this election means and how the pollsters and pundits got it wrong. We'll also have highlights of some important East County races, including some stunning upsets. From Public News Service, we'll hear about what veterans want from Donald Trump this Veterans Day. And then if you're looking for some relief of all this election week stress, on Destination East County, we'll have some exciting festivals and events kicking off the start of the holiday season across East County. So stay tuned for all these stories on the East County Magazine Show, where East County matters. Republican Donald Trump won a stunning upset to take the presidency in Tuesday's election, defying pollsters and pundits to win 290 electoral votes. Despite his extremely divisive rhetoric on the campaign trail, rhetoric that has often denigrated African Americans, Muslims, Latinos, women, and the disabled, as well as veterans, he struck a surprisingly conciliatory note in his acceptance speech, praising his opponent, and pledging to bring America together. Whether or not the Donald Trump of the campaign trail or the Donald Trump of election night will be the one we see in the White House, or perhaps a combination of both, remains to be seen. And here's an excerpt of what Trump had to say to his supporters on election night.
Hillary has worked very long and very hard over a long period of time, and we owe her a major debt of gratitude for her service to our country. I mean that very sincerely. Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country. As I've said from the beginning, ours was not a campaign, but rather an incredible and great movement made up of millions of hardworking men and women who love their country and want a better, brighter future for themselves and for their family. It's a movement comprised of Americans from all races, religions, backgrounds, and beliefs who want and expect our government to serve the people, and serve the people it will. Working together, we will begin the urgent task of rebuilding our nation and renewing the American dream. I've spent my entire life in business looking at the untapped potential in projects and in people all over the world. That is now what I want to do for our country. Tremendous potential. I've gotten to know our country so well. Tremendous potential. It's going to be a beautiful thing. Every single American will have the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it. We will also finally take care of our great veterans. We've been so loyal, and I've gotten to know so many over this 18-month journey. The time I've spent with them during this campaign has been among my greatest honors. Our veterans are incredible people. We will embark upon a project of national growth and renewal. I will harness the creative talents of our people, and we will call upon the best and brightest to leverage their tremendous talent for the benefit of all. It's going to happen. We have a great economic plan. We will double our growth and have the strongest economy anywhere in the world. At the same time, we will get along with all other nations willing to get along with us. They will be. We'll have great relationships. We expect to have great, great relationships. No dream is too big. No challenge is too great. Nothing we want for our future is beyond our reach. America will no longer settle for anything less than the best.
Hillary Clinton called to congratulate Donald Trump on his victory on election night and gave her concession speech the next morning. And here's an excerpt of that.
This is not the outcome we wanted or we worked so hard for. And I'm sorry that we did not win this election for the values we share and the vision we hold for our country. But I feel pride and gratitude for this wonderful campaign that we built together, this vast, diverse, creative, unruly, energized campaign. You represent the best of America, and being your candidate has been one of the greatest honors of my life.
Mrs. Clinton urged her followers to respect the outcome of the election and give Donald Trump an opportunity to lead, but also made clear that Democrats would continue to fight for equality for all Americans. And then she ended her speech with a message for the young women of America.
I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now. And to all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams.
This is Miriam Raftery with an update on the elections in Lemon Grove. We have got a nail-biter of a race to fill Lemon Grove's mayoral seat vacated by retiring Mayor Mary Sessom. It is still too close to call. For a while, Councilwoman Raquel Vasquez was ahead by a mere 12 votes, and now Councilman George Gastel has jumped into the lead, but only by 19 votes. If elected, Vasquez would be the first African-American mayor in San Diego County. Gastel, a longtime council member and Lemon Grove School Board member, brings vast experience to his race. All precincts have been counted, so the outcome in this one is going to hinge on those provisional and late mail-in ballots. Now, in the Lemon Grove City Council race, Democrat David Arambula and Republican Matt Mendoza appear to have won election with about 22% and 21% of the vote, respectively. They beat out Jerry Selby, who fell short of his effort to regain his seat on the council with about 15%, also defeating Steve Brown, Michael Summers, Charlene McAdory, and Glenn Thornton. Measure V, which would have legalized and regulated medical marijuana dispensaries, failed to win passage in Lemon Grove with about 52% voting no and 48% in favor. It's unclear at this point What impact California voters' passage of a statewide initiative legalizing recreational marijuana may have on the availability of medical marijuana in Lemon Grove, however.
This is Gene Carpenter with the results of the races in La Mesa. Democrats picked up a seat on the La Mesa City Council. Colin Parent, an attorney and affordable housing advocate who served in Governor Jerry Brown's administration, has won election, narrowly defeating incumbent Ruth Sterling, a Republican. Parent is currently legal counsel for Circulate San Diego, a group advocating for transit-friendly communities. Councilwoman Christine Alessio, an attorney, won re-election to her seat. Parent will be the lone Democrat on the five-member council. Campaigns for city council are ostensibly nonpartisan. Both parties put heavy resources into this race. Sterling has long been one of La Mesa's most popular politicians, winning past re-elections by wide margins, but she missed the key La Mesa debate this election cycle due to falling and breaking her arm. Sterling had initially announced she would not seek re-election, but later changed her mind after constituents urged her to run. With 100% of precincts counted, but late mail-in ballots and provisionals remaining to be tallied, Alessio has 36% of the vote, Parent has 35%, and Sterling 30%. La Mesa residents also narrowly approved Measure U, an initiative to legalize and regulate medical marijuana dispensaries by approximately a 51.4% to 48.6% margin.
This is Miriam Raftery with the results of the Santee races. Councilman John Minto, a retired police officer, is the new mayor in Santee, defeating realtor Rob McNellis. Current Mayor Randy Wappel also won election handily to the State Assembly over Leo Hamill. All are Republicans. Though Santee's council has long been heavily influenced by developers and real estate interests, Stephen Houlihan, running on an environmental platform, has beaten two pro-development opponents. Houlihan won out over Mason Heron, Assemblyman Brian Jones' aide who attracted hefty contributions from developers and out-of-town donors, as well as Dustin Trotter, a contractor. Houlihan led the successful campaign to stop the Quail Brush gas power plant near Mission Trails Regional Park, and he's pledged to end traffic gridlock in Santee. He was backed by Preserve Wild Santee, which has fought to protect open spaces and oppose sprawling development in the community. He will fill a vacancy left by the retirement of Councilman Jack Dale.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This is Miriam Raftery with the outcomes of elections in El Cajon. There will soon be two new faces on the El Cajon City Council. Ben Colasso, president of the Chaldean Chamber of Commerce, an Iraqi-American who was endorsed by the Democratic Party, has won election to the formerly all-Republican council. Steve Goebel, a business executive and longtime community volunteer, also won election. Long-serving Councilman Bob McClellan won re-election, but appointed Councilmember Star Bales lost her seat. It was a crowded field of 10 candidates, and voters opted to largely ignore recommendations made by the Democratic and Republican parties, which had each endorsed three candidates, but only one from each slate was elected. Similarly, of the Conservative Lincoln Club's slate, only Councilman McClellan won. Goebel, running independently of any slate, scored a surprise upset in this race. El Cajon voters also handily approved Measure S, the redistricting proposal to establish district elections, which passed with approximately 69% support from voters. The move to district elections starting in 2018 could mean more changes coming to El Cajon, long a conservative bastion, but now a city that is a majority of ethnic and racial minorities, with registration trending Democratic.
This is Gene Carpenter with results in the Cajon Valley Union School Board race. Republicans scored victories here, winning both open seats up for grabs. Karen Clark Mejia, an educator, took 30% of the vote, while Jim Miller, an attorney, business owner, and parent, took 29%. Miller had previously run for a Superior Court judicial seat, but lost after revelations that he had been removed as a judge pro tem. He opposes the Common Core curriculum. The Cajon Valley School Bond Initiative Measure EE appears to have narrowly missed the 55% needed for passage. With 100% of precincts counted, but late mail-in and provisionals remaining, the measure has 54.9% yes, 45.1% no out of nearly 30,000 votes cast.
The Grossmont Union High School District has been riddled with controversies, including efforts by parents to split the district apart after the board ignored admonishments by the county grand jury and refused to build an Alpine High School promised in two past bond measures. On Tuesday, voters cast out incumbent Jim Stieringer, the newest board member, in an anti-establishment wave that swept across the country election day. His replacement in Trustee District 2, the La Mesa-Mount Helix area, is a teacher. Voters also elected a teacher in District 1 in Lemon Grove-Spring Valley-La Prensa, carved out through redistricting as a majority-minority district. Now here's what we can learn from those races. Stieringer was in a lose-lose position. After he voted to oppose continuing the district's lawsuit defending its refusal to build that Alpine High School, the Republican Party endorsed Bible teacher Kevin Conover over Stieringer, hoping to continue its domination of the board. But with 100% of precincts counted, the winner in District 2 is Elva Salinas, a community college teacher whose endorsement by the American Federation of Teachers likely swayed voters to put her in first place. Stieringer finished second. Conover finished third, and Odai Yusuf, Jr., a university student who was endorsed by the Democratic Party, finished fourth. Salinas is also a registered Democrat, but was not endorsed by the party. In District 1, that's an open seat due to being a new trustee district created through redistricting, the winner was a teacher and a Democrat, Chris Feit, who got about 31% of the vote. Feit ran a stealth campaign with no website, but the muscle of the party's official endorsement apparently was enough to beat out three other challengers in what is ostensibly a nonpartisan race, but where both parties had much at stake. Steve Babbitt, a member of the La Mesa Spring Valley School District Board, took 26% of the vote, followed by Richard Preciado and preacher Roland Slade. A byproduct of redistricting in the Grossmont District may be a breakup of the power long held by both the Republican Party and megachurches. Though three incumbents long backed by conservative religious leaders and megachurch parishioners in more heavily Republican-leaning districts will not face re-election until 2018. The votes also reflect a power struggle between the American Federation of Teachers and the Grossmont Education Association, the local teachers' union, which did not endorse any candidate in the race. Voters could have a chance to break up the board's conservative majority sooner, however, if the state and voters approve a request by Alpine parents and the Alpine Union School District to break off from Grossmont and unify the Alpine District, which wishes to expand from elementary and middle school to high school. A suit seeking to take back funds raised by Propositions H and U to build that Alpine High School remains in court. If the split-up is approved by the state, and ultimately voters, sources have advised East County Magazine that Trustee Jim Kelly, who lives in the area slated to be dropped from the Grossmont District, would ultimately lose his seat if he stays there. And of course, the split-up would trigger redistricting all over again. Grossmont's bond measure BB, meanwhile, appears to have narrowly won approval from voters by just under 58%, with 55% needed for passage. Voters made clear that they want to keep seeing improvements to the district schools, while voting to infuse the Grossmont board with new faces that they hope are not controlled by the same forces that have long dominated the school board and opposed the will of voters in carrying out the bond requirements. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Proposition C, the measure that would allow the Chargers to build a new downtown stadium and convention center near Petco Park in the East Village and raise the hotel tax to 16.5% from its current 10.5%, failed to garner the two-thirds it needed to pass on Tuesday, with a vote total of 56.96% no and 43.04% yes. The team said the Convadium could be used around 300 days a year. The Chargers and NFL would have provided $650 million towards the project. In terms of what comes next for the Chargers, it's just too early to give you an answer, team chairman Dean Spano said. We are going to diligently explore and weigh our options and do what is needed to maintain our options. But no decision will be announced until after the football season concludes, and no decision will be made in haste. San Diego voters know a bad deal when they see it, City Councilman Chris Cade, who voted against the proposal, told City News Service. Now the ball is in the Chargers' court in terms of whether or not they want to have a negotiation, have a dialogue with the city and other stakeholders in order to get a deal done that's in the best interest of both the team and taxpayers. Spano sent the following letter after midnight on Wednesday morning to Chargers fans and season ticket holders. Despite the fact that Measure C failed to receive a two-thirds majority, I wanted to reach out right away with a very sincere thank you for your loyal support as a fan and for considering our initiative. There is much we can be proud of tonight. The 110,000 residents who qualified the measure in just 6 short weeks. The vocal and passionate support from our fan groups and corporate partners. The strong endorsements and hard work of numerous civic, business, and labor leaders, and the heartfelt efforts of our alumni and players. In terms of what comes next for the Chargers, it's just too early to give you an answer. We are going to diligently explore and weigh our options and do what is needed to maintain our options. But no decision will be announced until after the football season concludes, and no decision will be made in haste. The outpouring of support from friends like you and so many others has been heartwarming throughout the campaign, and I will continue to be mindful of that in the weeks ahead. Thank you again for believing in the Chargers. Everyone on the team and in my family appreciates your loyal support and continued patience, and we look forward to an exciting rest of the season. Sincerely, Dean A. Spanos. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alper.
Voters countywide resoundingly defeated Measure A and Measure B on Tuesday's ballot. Measure A, the Sandag-backed half-cent sales tax increase to fund transit, received 57%, falling short of the two-thirds plurality needed for passage. Now it will be back to the drawing board for Sandag, which faced opposition from some environmentalists who contended it placed too much emphasis on freeways first over mass transit and pedestrian or bicycle-friendly improvements. On the other hand, Sandag also drew criticism from others who contended there was not enough money for roadway improvements, making it a tough slog to find a compromise that can win enough future votes for passage. Measure B, a creative developments initiative that sought to bypass planning and environmental review to obtain voter approval of the Lilac Hills massive housing and multi-use project in Valley Center, went down to a resounding defeat with over 64% voting no and less than 36% voting yes. The developer has indicated it will continue efforts to get the project built, but the pathway becomes much more difficult. A creative could seek approval through the county supervisors, but with Bill Horn forced by the FPPC to recuse himself due to conflicts of interest, a creative would have to convince three of the four remaining supervisors to defy the will of the voters to approve the project or dramatically scale back its plans and start over with a revised proposal. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. This week, the big story, of course, is the surprise upset victory of Donald Trump winning the presidency. Today, we have assembled a panel of East County residents and pundits and analysts. I have with me Gene Carpenter, who is the co-founder of La Mesa Conversations, a political discussion group, Kim Cooney, a teacher and a Republican who voted for Donald Trump, and Jonathan Goetz, our political writer who also has an economics background. Thank you all for joining us on the show today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Miriam.
I would like to start with Gene. Gene, you're a longtime political observer. Many people in the Democratic Party were very surprised that Hillary Clinton, who arguably had the most impressive resume, at least, of any candidate to run in a long time, she would have been the first woman elected to the White House, and yet she was soundly defeated. Mr. Trump received 290 electoral votes. He needed 270 to win. Mrs. Clinton got 228. How do you think the pundits and the pollsters and the media got it so wrong?
Oh, thank you, Miriam. How did they get it wrong? They seemed on the coverage Tuesday evening to be in a state of shock that all these states were going to the person they had predicted they would not go to. I found it disheartening to realize that all this time that they have been preaching and conveying all the disadvantages of Trump, the voters chose to vote for the very person they said that they shouldn't vote for. So I think the media had a lot of impact and responsibility for getting it so wrong because they simply wanted the public to vote the way they thought they should vote.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. We know now that the Democratic National Committee was backing Mrs. Clinton very strongly, very early in the race, and they sort of dismissed Bernie Sanders as this flash in the pan, the Jewish socialist that couldn't possibly win. But they actually went beyond just not openly supporting him. They had pundits in place on some of these major networks who were positioning themselves as neutral analysts, but in fact, some of them actually came out of the Clinton campaign. And so one has to wonder if they weren't doing that, you know, perhaps the Sanders surge at the end would have been a surge at the beginning that we don't know. Do you think he could have pulled in voters in some of those Rust Belt states that Mr. Trump won, states like Ohio, states like Pennsylvania, possibly Michigan that as of this taping is still too close to call? You know, the states where we've seen so much of the manufacturing go overseas and where Sanders was drawing big crowds talking about the wealth gap and, you know, like Mr. Trump, the need to bring jobs back from overseas.
Well, as someone that stood in line for 6 hours to see Bernie Sanders at downtown San Diego, I saw what seemed to me like a 95% of millennials that attended and very few people of older generations. There was something that Bernie was resonating that the Clinton folks didn't seem to be able to hear or willing to hear. And then with all the revelations of WikiLeaks showing that the DNC, starting with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and then it continued throughout up until Election Day of the kind of things that were happening behind the scenes at the DNC, I think it all was relevant to why Hillary Clinton lost.
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective. We'll just never know if there would have been enough of those young voters to come out in the Rust Belt states or whether he might have resonated with an older crowd there. Or perhaps the result would have been just the same. We will never know. Kim, I'd like to turn to you as a white, educated woman who voted for Donald Trump. Can you tell us your reasons why?
I myself have always been more conservative than liberal. And in this case, in the beginning, I was a little skeptical about Donald Trump. I just wondered if he was really serious about his campaign and what he wanted to do for this nation. But the more I listened to him, and what he was promising, he says he's promising, you know, the United States, I felt that he was reaching out to people like myself, middle-class people that wanted to, you know, get that back again, get the, you know, the feeling of, you know, we don't want to lose, you know, what we have. And he, being that he's worked all his life, his family following his footsteps, and just the things that he's talked about with regard to economics, wants to create new jobs, wants to work on this terrorist situation, work on this, you know, just everything basically in this nation that's really gone downhill. I think that he's really somebody that I really thought I'd want to vote for.
Okay, so for you, it sounds like economics was a driving force along with the fears of terrorism, certainly a very real fear there that some people have. Jonathan, another factor in this race that while it doesn't seem to have been a factor for Kim here, there certainly have been racial overtones. Mr. Trump did appeal to sort of a dark side, or what Van Jones, the commentator, said on, you know, the media last night, what he called a white backlash following the first black president. We now have a president who was actually endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan and who has called for the deportation of, you know, 11 million undocumented immigrants. To what degree do you think racism or white power played a role, perhaps, in this presidential race?
Well, I definitely think it's part of why the pollsters got it so wrong. In 1982, you had Tom Bradley. He was up in the polls in California, the African-American mayor of Los Angeles. People told the pollsters they were planning on voting for him. Once they got in the ballot box, they just couldn't check the box. And so I definitely think that we certainly saw a lot of racial overtones in this election, but also with him being tagged as erratic and having such a negative portrayal, people, I think, were less honest with pollsters than they were with what they actually really wanted in their gut once they got into that polling place.
Do you think there could also be a certain element of people, primarily men maybe, who just don't want to see a woman president? Is there some prejudice, perhaps still, against women in leadership that may have played a similar role?
Well, I think it's not just women in leadership, but it's especially, not only is it women in leadership, but it's strong women. There's a typical belief that if a woman is a strong woman, that she's a B-I-T-C-H. And we certainly saw a lot of that portrayal of Clinton, who has been hammered at for decades in the media.
Yeah. She is certainly a strong woman, and even Mr. Trump, you know, praised her for that. And she has been hammered, I think, more than any other political figure I can think of who's remained, you know, in the forefront in public life after the scandals during Bill Clinton's presidency when she was first lady, the, you know, Benghazi situation as Secretary of State, and, you know, so many other things, that the email scandals, and yet none of it really stuck. Every investigation, there were findings of no wrongdoing, and yet there's sort of a media echo chamber that just keeps that in the forefront.
But if I might, the email scandal, even though she was cleared of it the day before the election by Comey, it was also brought back up into the news. So the first thing that was on voters' minds was that email scandal. So even if she was cleared, it still was out in the news again the day before the election.
Well, very true. And we should note that nowadays in many states, the majority of people are not voting on election day. They're voting by early ballot, mail-in ballot, or early voting. So I think that very well could have had a negative influence on her campaign while the voting was going on, when FBI Director Comey came out and said that, you know, we found these emails on Anthony Weiner's, you know, computer that he shared with her aide, with Clinton's aide, Huma Abedin. And by the time they came around a few days later and said, oh, no, it was much ado about nothing, and these were duplicate emails or emails that had nothing to do with national security, it would have just been too late. I think the damage may already have been done. Now, there's another factor that I fault the media for not talking about. I think they should have. And that is, this is the first election we've seen since the Supreme Court decision that essentially gutted the Voting Rights Act and allowed states that had a history of racial discrimination to change voting laws and not have to have the pre-approval of Congress to do it. So we've seen things like what the investigative reporter Greg Palast discussed last week on our show, where he found this list of 7 million supposed duplicate voters that were being purged off of the rolls in red states, not blue ones, or states that had, you know, Republican secretaries of state. And what it was lists of primarily common minority names, and the middle names didn't match, the social securities didn't match. These weren't duplicate voters. These were just, you know, people that had similar names, and yet they lost their right to vote. And so who knows how much effect that had. There were certainly other kinds of purges that we saw, you know, the list of the tactics that were tried in various places, some successfully, some not. Some were challenged in court. It was very long, and I personally think that the media should have been done a much bigger job of exposing that, and as well as there were a few instances on the other side where the Trump people were, you know, accusing the Clinton people of dead people voting or whatever. But it should really be looked into more, and I think all forms of voter suppression, we should be seeing justice departments going after that and trying to put a stop to it, and not parties saying, we don't want to talk about it because it might discourage people from coming and voting if they think their votes are going to get stolen.
You are, know? You saying the system is rigged?
You know, I'm not going to say it's rigged everywhere. And we heard a lot of talking about Russian hacking. Let's hope that didn't go on, but who knows. But I certainly do think that rigging does happen. I, in the past, have won national journalism awards for exposing, for example, rigging of voting machines. And it wasn't speculation. It was actually fact that this did occur in some places where there were computer programs that were able to fix and switch votes in some places. Those particular voting machines were banned in California, partly as a result of that reporting, but they still have these in some other parts of the country. So Yeah, I mean, I think efforts to rig votes have gone on from the day the votes were first cast anywhere, probably. It's gone on from things as primitive as, I remember a race years ago in Potrero, where 2 weeks after an election, they found a ballot box full of ballots thrown out in the middle of a field someplace, you know, union ballot box stuffing, dead people voting, and now it's electronic hacking and purging of voter rolls and caging of voters. And I guess on the other side of the aisle, you have a governor in one state that did a last second pardon of a whole bunch of felons in a state where you could still do same day voter registration to try to kind of sway it the other way. It's, you know, I mean, it goes on and we chuckle over it. But what's not funny is when somebody who legitimately is registered, who legitimately has a right to vote in this country, is deprived of it because of cheating of any form. So that's my thought on that. So on another thought, Jonathan, you have an economics background. How has the stock market been reacting to the news of a Donald Trump win?
The market's divided into winners and losers. Some sectors are doing better than others. Solar stocks certainly are down.
Yeah, he wants to bring back coal and nuclear and oil and gas. And
pharmaceuticals are up with the threat of price controls being taken off the table. A lot of major banks are up. Which actually comes as a surprise. The main movement on the market today, as of airtime, mm-hmm. has actually been in the positive direction, which is a surprise to everyone. But a lot of that has to do with the speech that he gave that seemed to be a much more conciliatory than what you heard on the campaign trail.
That's true. You know, election night, let's point out that the Dow Jones took a nosedive. It went down something like 780 points
until
they closed
trading,
the market.
Futures trading.
Okay.
If I might add that there was a article this morning on Defense One noting how the defense industry stocks had skyrocketed. That's fear that, or the hope that we'll return to the Reagan era where we have a very, very strong military.
Now, one of the things we should note in terms of if we want to discuss what impact a Trump presidency will actually have is that he also has control now, or his party, the Republicans, have control solidly of the House of Representatives. They have about a 5-member margin also controlling the Senate, and very shortly he'll be able to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court, and assuming he picks a conservative, that will sway the balance to conservatives as well. So I think what's frightening to some on the liberal side of the aisle is there seem to be no checks and balances here. I'd like to hear from each of you. Do you think that he's going to continue in this sort of fiery rhetoric and appealing to perhaps the most, you know, conservative wing of the party as president? Or do you think that he's going to tack more to the middle, perhaps surprise some people on both sides of the aisle with just what he actually does and doesn't do?
Well, you're looking at somebody who actually gave money to Hillary Clinton when she was running for senator of New York. So he definitely may have been coming off as more partisan than he truly is during the election cycle.
Mm-hmm. I'm most concerned about and curious about what kind of boundaries President-to-be Trump is going to display to the public, and whether or not he actually has any boundaries and limiting his emotional outbursts and saying just anything that comes to mind. In that role as president, we haven't seen him. What will we see? Big question mark.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, his speech last night, to his credit, election night we're talking about, we're taping this on Wednesday, it was very conciliatory. It was sort of a kinder tone than we've heard out of Trump on the campaign trail, where he's largely been very inflammatory in his rhetoric. But he did talk about healing and bringing the nation together. So I hope one thing we can all agree on is that I hope he actually does that. You know, I think many people have doubts about that, and we're just going to have to see. As a citizen of the United States, I think the areas I'm most concerned about are the possible erosion of women's rights and civil rights in that Supreme Court pick, which would affect us for generations. You know, perhaps a pro-corporatist, you know, that he could pick, as he is a billionaire. And my other concern is simply for our neighbors and friends who are of Mexican or Latino or Muslim descent or the LGBT community, the disabled people, but particularly the 11 million people who have been living in America in the shadows, who are not documented, but many of them were brought here as children and really did nothing wrong except to be born to somebody, you know, who came here undocumented. And so my heart kind of goes out to those folks, and I'm very interested to see what Congress will really do. Are they really going to try to help him in this goal he has to deport 11 million people, or are saner minds going to prevail and say, apart from the humanitarian aspect of that, it would be so expensive that the U.S. economy really can't afford that. Let's sit down and let's come up with a more realistic way to address this that perhaps tries to have some, you know, a little bit more balance than what he's been talking about wanting to do.
Well, he, when pushed on the deportation of the 11 million people, or at least that of his spokespeople, had really, I don't want to say backed down from that pledge, but certainly had not renewed it as they did with the vigorously as he did early on in the campaign.
We did see Marco Rubio regain his Senate seat or win re-election to his Senate seat in Florida. And Rubio was someone who opposed Trump early on, but he's best known for having been one of the 8 senators that carved out, you know, sort of a model immigration reform under the Obama presidency, a bipartisan reform that would have granted a path to citizenship for some undocumented immigrants while at the same time making sure if they were criminals and things, they would be deported. And of course, the Republican Congress would not approve that. Will a Republican Congress under a President Donald Trump do any differently? I don't know. And I think that's one of the really huge, huge question marks out there that remains to be seen. The other concern I've been hearing from climate change advocates who are deeply disturbed about having a president who denies climate change, who may undo the Paris Climate Accord, and who wants to move us in the direction of more fossil fuels and away from solar or other forms of clean energy. But Kim, I'd like to hear from you as a Trump voter. What do you, you know, A, most hope he will do? I think you've mentioned a little, but also are there things in his platform that you were concerned about that you know, perhaps don't support and hope may have been rhetoric that he doesn't follow through on?
Basically, a lot of what he has offered is what I agree with. I can't definitely state, you know, that everything he said isn't going to happen. I mean, every person that comes along to become president, they always make promises but never follow through. And this could be the same thing with Trump. And I've got to wait and see, but I think that he really is determined and he really has the passion to help the United States get back on its feet, economic feet, and to just help out, and minorities too. You know, we're a country of immigrants, and many of them, you know, want their children to go to school, be productive citizens, and they should be able to. And it's going to be interesting to see how
it sounds like you part ways with him a little bit when he's talking about wanting to deport 11 million people. Do you think that that's too extreme?
In a way, but I do, on the other hand, feel the people should come in as citizens. They should be able to go for their citizenship and, you know, like everyone else that comes in.
Very interesting. What about the climate change issue?
I am for the climate change. I don't feel that we need to depend on oil for the rest of our lives. And, you know, we're already doing that now. A lot of us homeowners are using the solar.
Yeah.
We're trying to go green.
So what I'm hearing is that as a Trump voter, you may be typical of many of them out there who voted for him because a particular issue or two or three issues resonated, but who don't agree with him on everything.
Right.
So maybe there is some room for Congress to perhaps moderate to the middle a little bit and not lose that base of Trump support, which obviously the Republican Party is going to want to try to hold on to for the future, while the Democrats are sort of licking their wounds and regrouping and trying to figure out what the heck happened in this election.
Right.
Does anyone else have any last thoughts that you'd like to add here?
I'd like to think that Donald Trump as president might turn some of that focus, that anger that he displayed so unconditionally towards the Democratic Party and Hillary, I hope he would turn a little bit of that to his own party and help us all figure out where the direction we need to go, what we want to accomplish as a country, and move forward in a positive way that will help us all make the United States a better place to live.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it takes somebody who can be a little bit of a bully or strongman to push things through. I'm thinking of Lyndon B. Johnson, you know, who sort of knew where all the skeletons were buried in Congress and wasn't afraid to use that information to get people to do what he wanted. But that is how we got, you know, the Civil Rights Bill passed. So perhaps if we were ever going to see comprehensive immigration reform, as did happen under President Reagan, you know, where we saw amnesty, and that was not a Democratic administration that did it all that long promised it. It was Republicans that actually made it happen. So who knows? You know, he has changed his mind on so many positions. I think sometimes we don't know which Donald Trump we're going to see as president. So I think the verdict is still out on that. But I really want to thank all of you for taking the time to sit down and talk with us and, offer your opinions, and it's going to be a roller coaster ride the next 4 years, but we're going to be here doing our best to make some sense out of it. So thank you.
Thank you,
Miriam. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Rebecca Williamson
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week. This week's Destination East County includes breakfast with firefighters in Santee, Kids Dance Company's production of 1968, a V-Course Museum holiday lunch, a wine and painting gathering in La Mesa,
and the Spinners live in concert at Sequan. Plus, we'll tell you about coming attractions, including a turkey bowl in Spring Valley, Casa de Oro's first fall festival, the Mother Goose Parade, Pomegranate Days at the Oasis Camel Farm in Ramona, the Jesus Christ Superstar Musical at San Diego State, Breakfast with Santa in Santee, a Jingle Paws Walk for Pets, Lakeside Spirit on Main, and a Country Christmas in Julian.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
On November 12th, you're invited to breakfast with Santee firefighters and sheriff's deputies from 7 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. This event will be held at Santee Fire Station No. 5 at 9130 Carlton Oaks Drive. Activities include face painting, a dunk tank, a balloon artist, and music.
Kids Dance Company will present 1968 at the San Diego Performing Arts Center on November 11th and 12th at 7 p.m. The production will show you how 1968 changed the world and in many ways parallels 2016. You can tap your toes to hit songs of 1968 and see how new works, including Mama Said and Kids Dance Company's 1968/2016.
The Weekhorst Museum invites you to welcome the holidays at its annual holiday luncheon on Thursday, November 17th. This festive event is from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. You can enjoy a catered luncheon by Cupid's Catering, an opportunity drawing, and view paintings and sculptures by famous Western artist Olaf Weghorst. For tickets, you can visit weghorstmuseum.org.
If you're looking to enjoy an artistic experience while sipping wine, you can learn how to paint your own masterpiece with Paintaholics at the San Pasquale Tasting Room in La Mesa on November 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. Beginners are welcome at this event, which features instruction by a professional artist. Learn more in the events section at sanpasqualewinery.com.
The Spinners, a rhythm and blues group popular since the 60s, will be performing at Sequan's Live and Up Close Theater on November 18th at 8 p.m. Their Motown sounds include such hits as Working My Way Back to You, Could It Be I'm Falling in Love, and Then Came You. For tickets and details, visit sequan.com.
You're invited to gobble up some fun at the Spring Valley Community Center Turkey Bowl on Saturday, November 19th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Spring Valley Community Center. There will be a cornucopia, family-friendly activities including games, face painting, bounce houses, free lunch, and raffle prizes. There, you will even be given a chance to win a turkey dinner.
The Casa de Oro Community Alliance announces their first annual fall festival on Saturday, November 19th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. The festival will be held in the Casa de Oro Plaza across the street from Starbucks in the 9700 block of Campo Road. Family fun, games, live music, children's interactive crafts, and the Fern Street Circus with face painting and entertainment will be provided. The Alliance is also sponsoring a food drive for families in need for the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday. Non-perishable donations are greatly appreciated. For more information, visit the Casa de Oro Community Alliance on Facebook.
On Sunday, November 20th, the Mother Goose Parade will again march down Main Street for the 70th year. Also known as the Children's Parade, it begins at 1 p.m. See over 100 colorful and exciting parade entries, including floats, marching bands, clowns, equestrians, local dignitaries, and Santa Claus. The route is downtown Main Street from El Cajon Boulevard to First Street. This popular parade is one of the largest in Southern California, kicking off the holiday season. To learn more, you can visit mothergooseparade.org.
If you're looking for an unusual way to spend Thanksgiving weekend, you can stop by Pomegranate Days at the Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona. The sixth annual event on November 25th, 26th, and 27th will include camel rides, feeding pomegranates to camels, family-friendly shows, and a race featuring pardoned turkeys. You can also do holiday shopping at a gift shop featuring such items as camel milk soaps and lotions. For full details, visit cameldairy.com.
In honor of Shop Small Business Saturday, a holiday pop-up market will be held on November 26th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. outside the Upper Hands at 13910 Lions Valley Road in Jamul. Guests can shop for unique gifts including handmade hats, scarves, and gloves, gift baskets, jams, jellies, and tamales, jewelry, fine art, poinsettias, holiday floral arrangements, and vintage collections. A fashion show will take place 1:30 p.m. A holiday pajama drive will also be held. Bring donations of new PJs for children ages 1 to 16 to help make a kid in need feel cozy for the holidays.
You can enjoy holiday musical performances at Parkway Plaza on the Macy's stages starting November 26th through December 24th. Upcoming performances include the Southwestern College Big Band on November 26th and the Celtic Nations Pipe Band on December 10th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. There are more musical groups and additional events coming up at Parkway Plaza in El Cajon, including visits by Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus. For a full schedule of events, visit shoppingparkwayplaza.com/events.
Christmas comes to Julian every year in an old-fashioned way that will make you picture sleigh rides, chestnuts roasting on an open fire, and just maybe Jack Frost painting the whole town white. This year's Julian Country Christmas will be held on November 26th from 2 to 7 p.m. in front of the Julian Pioneer Museum. The Country Christmas event kicks off on holiday season with the annual lighting of the town's huge living Christmas tree presented by the Julian Merchants Association. This is a popular event drawing hundreds of visitors who gather at Pioneer Park to watch the lighting and visit with Santa. Located in the Cuyamaca Mountains, this historic gold mining town is apt to have a chill in the air. The holiday season in Julian also offers an opportunity to shop at small boutiques and craft shows for one-of-a-kind gifts in the show's famous apple pies. For details, see julianca.com.
The pop rock musical Jesus Christ Superstar will be presented at San Diego State University's Don Powell Theater on December 1st through the 4th. This explosive psychedelic concert with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber is a collaboration between the schools of theater, television and film, and music and dance, telling a universally known biblical story through the unusual perspective of Judas Iscariot. The performances feature the SDSU Aztec Concert and Chamber Choirs, as well as the SDSU Symphony Orchestra. For tickets, visit the SDSU Theater Department.
On Saturday, December 3rd, the ACES Foundation will be hosting the 6th Annual Jingle Paws 1K and 5K Run Walk from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College. Registration is from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. The ACES Foundation's mission is to support the El Cajon Animal Shelter. They have helped over 20 animals become adoptable by paying for surgeries and other procedures this year. There will also be a Santa's Village immediately after the walk with doggy goodies and pet food vendors, pictures with Santa, refreshments, and a silent auction. The Santa's Adoption Village will also have resource organizations and adoptable pets. Shots for pets will also be available for vaccines. To register and get more information, visit acesfoundation.org.
You can take the kids to breakfast with Santa Claus at the Lakeside Community Center on Saturday, December 3rd from 8 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. Lakeside firefighters and sheriff's deputies will be serving up the community breakfast. In addition to meeting Santa, children can enjoy other activities as well at this festive community event.
The Lakeside Chamber of Commerce invites you to enjoy the spirit of Christmas on Main Avenue in downtown Lakeside on Saturday, December 3rd from 4 to 9 p.m. Santa and his elves are hard at work getting ready for Christmas at this annual event that attracts and delights people of all ages. There will be an atmosphere of an old-fashioned hometown Christmas. The event features all the sights and sounds of Christmas, including local school performances, Santa Claus, food and drinks, kid activities, jump jumps, rides, booths, crafters, and lighting the community Christmas tree.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, November 11th, 2016. I'm Eric Tegedoff. Here's what we're following on Veterans Day. President Obama meets with Trump to discuss transition. Veterans ask the president-elect to fulfill his pledge to them. President-elect Donald Trump got his first taste of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Thursday. Trump met with President Barack Obama at the White House, saying a 10- or 15-minute talk turned into a 90-minute meeting. In a press conference after the meeting, Trump expressed his gratitude for President Obama.
Mr. President, it was a great honor being with you, and I look forward to being with you many, many more times in the future.
On Thursday, Trump also met with Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The president-elect spoke a lot on the campaign trail about helping veterans. Now that Trump has been elected, veterans advocates say they're ready for that talk to turn into action.
Augusta veteran Gary Burns, who served in the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division in Vietnam, says when Donald Trump takes the oath of office in 10 weeks, he needs to keep the momentum going for reforms that have been made in the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Well, I think what he's going to do in Maine is continue the course they're taking in Maine. It's not broken. He needs to make sure it continues to be properly staffed and properly funded.
No matter what, Burns says the VA should not be privatized, and he hopes President-elect Trump gets that message. The lame duck session of Congress starts next week with many issues important to veterans at stake, including legislation dealing with the backlog of appeals made to the VA.
That was Mike Clifford reporting.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.